Welcome to Beauty and the Brain with your hosts, Dr. Chris Crowley and nurse practitioner Jerry Drinkard. Get ready to dive into the latest in revolutionary treatments, cutting-edge devices, and wellness secrets. Whether you're a consumer or provider, we're here to empower you at the forefront of beauty and aesthetics.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Beauty and the Brain, the podcast where we discuss all things aesthetics. I'm your co-host, Dr. Chris Crowley.
And I'm Jerry Drinkard, family nurse practitioner. Together, Chris and I own Skin and Tonic, med spa that's located in Pace, Florida. And today we're going to be talking about a topic that we kind of talk about a lot.
We talk about all the time, filler misinformation. And so constantly there are people watching social media, so Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and there's a lot of influencers out there that proclaim to be medical experts that are giving medical information about hyaluronic acid fillers and what they do, really with no medical background and no true understanding of the products and how they work. And so I think today we're going to try to dispel of that information and actually share some medical facts about hyaluronic acid fillers.
We talk about social media often because there's a lot of good information out there. It's obviously something that's really good for our business because it's a relatively low cost way of advertising, but there's so much misinformation out there as well. And so, but this is also something that we have to talk about on a daily basis with patients, because patients also come in with fears that they, you know, are oftentimes like calls from what they've seen on TikTok or Instagram or whatever. So I think being knowledgeable about the filler, the process, and what happens once it's in the body.
Well, we were just shown some videos, some Instagram videos from these influencers that really, it kind of, to me, is the height of what we're dealing with. And as you guys can see, if you watch the videos, we'll put the links on the YouTube channel or on the bottom of this. But if you go and watch some of this, you'll see these people. I don't even want to give their names any credibility at this moment, but you'll see that a lot of these people are saying that you can have pillow face or filler migration, that fillers won't dissolve, that they're permanent, they're not temporary. You know, there's a lot. We've done some episodes similar to this before, and we've even had comments where people will say, you know, why haven't you been educating patients that these things will never go away? And that's simply not the case. So we do know that there are things about it that we're learning more about fillers as we go along, and that they may last longer than we initially think. But, you know, to really have the concept of the mind that they never go away, they're permanent, is simply not true. So I think really to address these, we need to go over some of the myths and some of the things that were talked about in the social media. So filler dissolving or being permanent, filler migration and pillow face, and how we can address those problems should they occur. I think that's maybe the order that we should kind of go through this in the podcast. And so we'll start with, you know, filler dissolution or filler dissolving naturally over time. So how do you explain that to patients? How do you tell them how long it's going to last and how it's going to dissolve?
Well, there are a lot of factors that go into it. And so I think, first of all, there are things to know that all fillers are not created equal, all are not created the same. And just as people are not created equal, and we're not created the same. So when we put a substance into our body, whether it's insulin, whether it's a filler, or whether it's simple sugar, they all react differently. And so I think knowing how your body reacts to filler is one way. And so, you know, we all metabolize things at different rates, and the filler is designed to last different amount of times. And so I think it's important to educate patients, and so that way they can at least make informed decisions about getting fillers prior to ever making that decision to commit to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, from the nerdy side of me, and it's probably too much information for patients. This is more when I teach the classes and talk to the injectors. I do it very similar to what you said. Everybody's a little bit differently. And the fillers are, the ones we're talking about specifically today are hyaluronic acid fillers. And these are, hyaluronic acid is a substance that's naturally in our body. We all have it. We're continually making it, but our body also breaks it down. And a lot of different things that we do can speed up how quickly or how slowly we break down our own natural filler. And so if we didn't inject anything into our bodies, on about a 24 to 48 hour cycle, we're kind of making this hyaluronic acid filler. And through enzymes and other processes in our body, it kind of goes away. When any of the companies make these commercial hyaluronic acid fillers that we inject, usually to correct an area where you've had a lot of volume loss, what they do is they cross-link those particles together. So they use some sort of chemical mechanism to link it together so our body can't break it down as quickly. So depending on how much of the product they put in there, the type of way that they cross-link that together, our bodies can't break it down or dissolve it as quickly. But as you said, there's individual variants. So we see marathon runners, people who are on starvation diets, all of those highly metabolically active patients will have a higher amount of that natural occurring substance called hyaluronidase. So it's the same thing that we can put in a vial and inject to dissolve it if there's a problem. But because our body is making a lot of that enzyme, we can also naturally break down the hyaluronic acid fillers more quickly. So we hear this all the time when we have our weightlifters, our, again, marathon runners. They'll come in and they say they go through their filler really quickly. So when we think it should last, you know, 9 months, and they come in at month 4 or 5 and they're like, all my filler, it seems like it's went away. A lot of times they have had higher amounts of that naturally occurring enzyme and they'll go through it in a quicker fashion. So it is all based on individual patient characteristics. Some of them will go through it more quickly than others. But the bottom line is we are still breaking it down. It is not a permanent substance. That being stated, we also know that it may last longer than we think in some cases, and especially in certain areas. So when we inject this in different tissue planes, it may last in those areas a lot longer than we think. And so we see people years later after areas like under eye filler or tear trough filler, that they come in and we would think the filler should be gone. But if we look with ultrasound, we'll still see some of that filler could be there. And so it doesn't maybe all go away. It may not all go away at the same rate. And a lot of that will be dependent on the patient characteristics as well as where we inject that filler.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things, and it's something that I commonly talk to patients about, is the duration of a filler's life depending on where in the body it's used. And we'll talk a little about migration with this as we go on too, but the thing is, in an area where you have a lot of movement, then that filler is probably not going to last as long as it will as if you were to place it down on the bone in an area that has less movement. Again, I think it's something that's important to know, and it's also important to know about, like, what are you putting there? What's the filler?
Yeah, so I think it's a good point to now kind of transition and talk a little bit about filler migration. And so maybe for people who have never heard of that, you just want to describe kind of what that means and what we're looking for when we address that problem.
Yeah, a simple way of saying migration when we're referring to filler is the filler ends up in an area that we didn't put it intentionally. And the filler moves from that area into another area and oftentimes makes the result less desirable. I would say the most common that people complain about is lips. I think in more recent time, we see just about as much tear trough migration as we do with lip filler, don't you think?
We could look at the numbers and actually see. I think anecdotally, it seems that lip filler migration was a lot more talked about for a while. But I believe as we're starting to image areas more and look at ultrasound, and I believe we are seeing this maybe more under the eye in areas that people didn't think it was filler. They identified it as something else. But now as we're looking, we can tell that it may be filler that has migrated.
And it may be trends and injections. I mean, for years, you didn't hear near as much talk about, like, tear trough injections. And I think that's probably because of a surge in social media. But lip injections have been very popular for a long time, and especially overfilled lips. And that's one of the things that can cause it. I mean, there are a lot of different things that can cause migration: technique, the speed of injecting it, the material that's being injected, how much material is already in an area before you inject.
I think there's so many things that go into it that we do see it. But I can also tell you for years, I don't know, I'd have to look back, but maybe 10 years into this practice, we didn't see lip filler migration. We saw where people had injected poorly, or maybe they came to us from other practices. But in our patient population, we didn't see it. But we also never did a vertical injection technique. We only did, and so I think we were limited somewhat in the shapes we could create And I think we're much better now at matching what the patient's needs, wants, desires are to our skill level and creating those results. But as a result of that, we do have a little bit higher migration. We still don't see it often, but it's a technique. So as you said, it's the product you inject, the technique you use to inject it, and in the area that you inject it. And so areas that tend to move more may squeeze filler out if we're using injection techniques where we're breaking natural barriers. So for a while, we were taught these vertical injection techniques where we would go, and we even went outside of the vermilion border up in the white roll or even higher sometimes to really evert the lips. But as we would do that with those vertical fence posts, it created a channel that the filler could squeeze out. So if we put a lot of filler in these tiny little channels, it would squeeze out and migrate over time. Same thing with the eyes. We could put it, and if we did it, you know, superficially in that muscle contracts, it's concentric, it would squeeze it into other areas. I think the other thing that a lot of the social media influencers are discussing now, some of the studies that show it kind of moving all over the face. And for a while, it was, you know, popular that you would just go in the dermis or immediately subdermal, and you would inject filler to smooth a superficial wrinkle. We do know now that aging, as the aging process occurs, there's a lot of things occurring at different levels. So the bone changes, the deep fat pads change. And in general, I think your approach is the same, but in general, I correct the deep layers first. And so I'm correcting the deep fat pads. I'm replacing volume loss on the periosteum with a higher G prime filler. And then I only do the final amounts in that more superficial plane. And I think the more of that we put in the superficial plane, the more likely we're to see that, especially the thinner products, move to some other areas.
Well, I also think that when you're injecting in those deeper planes, you're less likely to see some of these pillow face things that we're talking about. If you mimic bone, you can mimic a more natural look. Obviously, if you overfill, it's going to have that appearance of being overfilled and not natural, but following the bone, following the natural contour of the face. But I think when people really start chasing lines, chasing wrinkles, and putting products in areas that they're not designed for, we have the smartest fillers that we've ever had today. Like, we have fillers now that are designed for tear troughs, lips. We have this design for superficial lines and wrinkles. We have filler to mimic bone. And this is something we never had in the past. I mean, we're so fortunate to have all these tools in our hand, but then when they're used inappropriately, and granted, I just said something about putting contour in lips, but if they're used inappropriately, then you can get undesirable results. And that's what we see. And like, everybody's saying some of these expressions.
I think you're being, you know, hard on yourself there when you said used inappropriately. I think that's where your education experience comes into play. And so for a long time, we only had two fillers on the, you know, one or two on the market, and we have dozens now that we can choose from, and worldwide there's you know, more than 100, probably. There's a lot. And I think as a, you know, as you get more education and become a more skilled injector, you can learn to use the properties of a filler that matches the problem that you're trying to address in a particular area. So when you mentioned that using contour and lips, that's not an FDA approved use for that product, but we're using it in an off-label fashion. So we're using an approved product in a different area than it was studied in, but you're using it specifically because you like the fact that it is a larger particle size that's very flexible, so it integrates well in the moving tissue. So it gives you a much more full-appearing lip. So for those patients who want those nice, full, plump lips, you can accomplish that because you know the characteristics of the product, the tissue depth to put it, and the way to minimize complications. It doesn't mean that we would never have one, but you're combining all of that 18 years of experience and education to come up with that plan. So I believe as injectors are just starting out, I always tell them the safest way is to follow where the FDA has approved these, because then they can reliably say, I have a product that was studied in this area, and if I use it the way it was studied and designed, I can predict this complication rate, which is usually pretty minimal or it wouldn't get approval. As you get more experience, you may decide to be more advanced in your technique and use things off-label, or you know, we always only use FDA-approved products, but sometimes we use them in different areas than they were studied in or approved in. So when we talk about that with migration, I think that's where, as you simply stated in the beginning, it just is in an area that wasn't intended to be.
Yeah.
But that's not necessarily, you know, a devastating consequence. It you know, when we have it in areas we don't intend it to be, like in an artery, that can then cause a lot of bad problems that we got to intervene on right away. When it migrates over time, over months or years, into areas that it wasn't originally injected, how do you deal with that with your own patients? And how do you deal with it with patients that come in from other practices? Because we also see a lot of patients that are coming to us from other areas that they've already been injected and they're asking us to fix problems. So how do you explain to them the problem that has occurred and then your plan for treating this?
So I'm always very honest with patients and always try to not talk about other injectors, because I don't think any injector intentionally does harm to a patient. I think sometimes the outcomes are not desirable for what that patient wanted, but who's to say it's not what the injector wanted? Because how many times do you say pick your injector based on what they look like? I've heard so many people say that in the past, but the way that I handle that is, if someone comes to me before treating them, if I feel like they're overfilled, I go right back. You were just talking about, you know, the product that's naturally found in our body, how we run that base. And so that's what I do, is I go straight to something to dissolve and try to start with as clean a slate as we can.
But a lot of patients will tell you, like, look, I paid all this money to have fill replaced. I've paid this money to get my lips filled. I don't want you to dissolve it now.
If you don't want to dissolve it, then it's probably the thing for you to do right now is get more filler on top of it, because it's going to compound and ultimately it looks bad on me.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it does look bad, but I agree with you. And I think patients need to understand that when we put a lot of filler in a tight space, that increases the chance it's going to move somewhere else. So it's a gel and it follows the path of least resistance. And so just like the way I explain it to patients that they seem to understand is breast implants. And so a lot of people seem to have a concept of breast implants. And if they want to go with really large breasts, they know they can't go from an A cup to these really large breasts, whatever size they're going for. Sometimes in one setting, they may need tissue expanders. They need to put something in there to stretch the skin, and then they can slowly upsize over time. I tell them it's a similar process with fillers. If you want these giant lips or giant cheeks, if I put a lot in there at one time, that space is so tight, it's likely to squeeze into other areas where I didn't intend for it to go. But if we put some there and we allow that tissue time to stretch, we can add more to it. But sometimes by the time they show up at our doorstep, they've already had so much added to a particular area that it's really tight. And so I think that's what you're talking about. And that I would say is, like, when it's that tight already, I can't put any more in there without it going somewhere else or migrating. And then if they tell me I don't want to dissolve it, I just say, well, I don't really have a good treatment option for you. We can try to selectively dissolve only portions that have migrated without dissolving the whole thing. That's not always possible. And so we can tell them, we can certainly aim for that. But I think, you do the same thing. I think Allie does the same thing. We actually include that as part of our discussion up front, that when we're using certain techniques, that migration is a possibility, and that if it occurs, we just want to, you know, we'll see them, we'll treat it. It's not a big deal. We can just put a couple of drops of the dissolving medication in the area that has migrated to try to take care of that problem without dissolving at all. Because I think patients, if they understand that it's a potential, not necessarily, bad outcome, but a potential side effect of a technique you're using, they're more likely to come back and trust you with their follow-up care than if you don't mention it at all. And now it's migrated out of their lips and they end up going to another injector and saying, look what, you know, Jerry or Chris did to me. I need you to fix it.
We probably will see more of that, because the trend's changing so much. We've seen it change just in the past year, even, of people wanting a more natural look. And so I do think that because of social media educated injectors, people will know more about, like, being able to dissolve and achieve a look that they want. And so I think that we'll probably be seeing a lot more, like, dissolving of fillers than we have in the past. You and I both have, like, we've been doing this along, like, dissolving things for a long time, but patients come to us and they trust us. And even with, you know, the aestheticians, oftentimes they're some of the first people to see our injectable patients, and they'll even start that discussion because they know how we treat.
Yeah, it's definitely a trend, I think, towards a more natural look. I think we have with the hyaluronic acid fillers, the message I wanted, like, really the patients to hear is that we do have safe and effective ways to reverse these or dissolve them should a complication occur. It's not our first thing that we reach for. There are definitely side effects that could occur with that and allergic reactions. We're not minimizing it, but it is a tool that we have to create really beautiful, natural results. So I think in the last segment of the podcast that maybe we'll try to do more of a kind of quick answers or rapid fire on some of the common myths out there that got sent in to us that we were asked to kind of address during this. So this is from some of our patients. So, we put them as myths. Sometimes this wasn't actually presented to us in that way. It was a question. So I'm going to just do it as myth 1 through 5 here. And you give me your quick answer and I'll give you mine. So myth 1, fillers look unnatural. Tell me how you can make them look natural when it's done properly.
This kind of goes back to your favorite, but biostimulators is to me one of the most natural approaches. Even though it's not technically a filler, it can work to fill volume deficits. It helps with if it's correctly placed, you can get a lot of lift, which is in the population that I treat in my chair. That's a very, very common request is lift. People that aren't quite ready for surgery. And so I love biostimulators for that purpose. Why don't you address gel fillers a little bit?
Well, so to me, when I hear fillers look unnatural, to me, that the key to a successful injector keeping them looking natural is to know and respect the natural anatomy. So when we try to create shapes that weren't there to start with, I can't take my lips and make them look exactly like Angelina Jolie. It's not my anatomy. It's not right for my face. And so when we try to create shapes that weren't there or weren't natural, that is when we get that unnatural look. So I think the gel fillers, the hyaluronic acid, I love biostimulants. It's a cornerstone of our treatments here. But with gel fillers, we can definitely keep a natural look, but you have to understand the anatomy and respect that patient's natural, unique anatomy.
So another question you can debunk is, are fillers permanent?
Yeah. So fillers are not permanent by any means. I think if they were, we'd be out of business, number one, because patients would get it and they would not have to come back to us. But we see that for a number of reasons, that may not be desirable either, because patients age, they have different needs at different stages of their life. And so the hyaluronic acid fillers are going to vary in duration anywhere from a few months, maybe up to 2 years. We know in some cases that we can do studies, MRIs, ultrasounds, and things like that years later, maybe, 6, 8 years later, and still see some remnants of it there. But it's not usually the full effect of the filler like it was when it was initially placed. There are some non-HA fillers, so some of our biostimulants that can last longer than others, that can be classified as semi-permanent or permanent, but that's things like Belafil, where we're using something that's a non-dissolvable agent that we're putting in to stimulate collagen. So it's not really the gel filler. So the hyaluronic acid fillers are temporary and they can be dissolved if needed. So we hear a lot of people think that fillers require frequent maintenance, that if they start doing it, they got to keep doing it and they got to do it often and it's expensive. So is that true?
Well, you just talked about the duration and how fillers on different fillers last different length of times. A question that I do get asked is, am I going to look worse after a year than I do now when my filler dissolves? Because most people know that fillers last somewhere around a year. And so that is one of the questions that I get. So as far as maintenance, I always think that there's maintenance, whether you maintain with filler or whatnot. I think that maintenance with some type of collagen stimulating treatment, and that's when I talk to people about what I do. Like, I like to do something at least quarterly. And that's some type of collagen stimulating, whether it's chemical peels, microneedling, CO2, Sculptra, Radius. There's a million things out there that you can do. So do I think fillers necessarily require maintenance? I think fillers have a lifetime, but I think skin requires maintenance.
Yeah, I mean, I like that answer a lot. Skin definitely requires maintenance. I also think where this myth comes into play is with this overdone look that we've seen in the past decade. And so the problem is filler is only going to replace volume. So it's not really doing a lot for the skin. The gel fillers are going to simply plump an area. If we stretch that area and we overdistend that area, then yes, as that goes away, that area may look worse because now we've stretched that tissue. So if we way overfill the lips, those lips are going to look empty and loose, and you're going to have a lot of wrinkles in them unless we keep the filler in it. And so I think that is a really important discussion for patients to have with their providers. As long as we're trying to keep it natural, keep the patients looking good for their age, maybe slightly younger, but we're not trying to make a 50-year-old look 20 again. And so we're not overstretching or overdistending the tissue, then they shouldn't look worse after the filler. And the injector should work with them on a plan, and they should be working with your estheticians and your skincare experts to really get them on a home regimen to protect their skin. Other than that, as long as they're not overdoing it, they shouldn't look worse after a year than they did when they had their filler.
Yeah, you just kind of, the next question is, can fillers replace a facelift? And you just kind of talked about that when it's, you can replace volume.
Yeah. And so sometimes patients have facelifts and they still need fillers. They have facelifts and they still need biostimulants. So, you know, surgical procedures are definitely still needed with many of these patients. It's one of the things where, you know, we talk about it this year, next year sometime. I definitely am looking at doing a lower face and a neck lift. You had a surgical neck lift. So as the tissue starts to sag, sometimes we need surgery to actually reposition that tissue. That's the best way to do that. But that doesn't mean that I don't need filler where volume loss has occurred, or biostimulants to keep my skin in good condition, or lasers to get rid of sun damage, photo damage. So they don't replace surgery or facelift by any means.
Well, it's not going to remove excess tissue, and oftentimes that's what's required. So
what do you think about people that you know, call, and they're calling every practice just looking for the cheapest option? Is that the way that you'd recommend people shop for their filler?
No, I think that shop for, I think for me, I love to hear when we get people because they were referred by a friend. Like, to me, that's the most flattering referral we get. But then I also love that, especially our younger population, that they look for Google reviews, and like a real Google review is like a huge compliment as well to us. And so, you know, when people start shopping for the cheapest one out there, we oftentimes see them in here for things we just talked about as far as correction.
And, you know, sometimes we are on the cheaper side at our practice.
Yeah,
we do a high volume. And so because of that, we get a really good, you know, discounts on some of our products because we buy so much of them in bulk. And we like to pass that on to our patients. And so when we can, we pass that on. So sometimes we are on the cheaper side, sometimes more expensive. You know, when we do business coaching, and I do a lot of the business classes, we talk about pricing strategies, and we have different ways to do that. I don't think price alone should be the reason that patients choose an injector. I love it when we can find something that works within that patient's budget. I understand and respect the budget. And anytime possible, we give them the best deals that we can. But I think education and safety are really going to be the key to a successful outcome.
One of the other questions was, are fillers painful? And so that's, I mean, the reality, it's a needle going into the skin, so there's always the potential for discomfort. We do everything in our power to minimize that. We use topical numbing agents as long as there's no allergies. We have, you know, the Zimmer. I was trying to think of the word. I couldn't think of the chiller.
It's a chiller device. Yeah, that's right.
We use the chiller device to apply cold. A lot of places use ice or, you know, cool vibrating tools and that sort of thing. And
laughing gas, numbing, yeah.
I certainly think it's a tolerable treatment, and most people do fine with it, even you.
Even me. You know, love how you throw that out there. So hopefully this episode has addressed some of the common misconceptions and myths about fillers. I hope that we've dispelled some of the TikTok and Instagram trends that you've seen from non-medical providers. And we are certainly happy to talk about this more with you individually here at the clinic. If you have more questions, actually send them in, because we love getting new podcast ideas and episodes directly from you guys. So thank you all for tuning in for another episode of Beauty and the Brain, and we look forward to seeing you next week.
We'll see you soon.